This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
In the early 19th century, when the white man in India became racist, very, very proud, and had this sense of white supremacy, and even religious supremacy. So they started to look down. When India was bled dry by the East India Company and its policies, when Indians actually became poor because of this foreign power that had occupied so much land, and so much intrigue was caused by this particular power, that the Indians, who were once upon a time the richest people in the world, became the poorest people in the world. So Nawab basically invaded the settlements and ended up killing some people. He put them in a very dark room. He crammed all the British captives in a dark room. And then they all, I mean, not all of them died, but many of them died. But this episode, this particular incident, was so inflated, so overreported and exaggerated in Britain at the time, that it, to this day, if you talk about the black hole of Calcutta, okay, Google it and you will think, wow, this must be a great catastrophe. It was a catastrophe, but less than 50 people died in this. He crammed these British captives in a room. They died of suffocation because it was hot, right? Many survived, but many died. And this episode was so inflated and overreported in Britain at the time, okay, to gain sympathy for what the East India Company officers were doing in Britain at the time. They started to basically support what these people were about to do in the future. So the Black Hole of Calcutta was used to depose the then Nawab Siraj ud-Daulah. So Clive of India, very famous, infamous personality in the history of India, Clive, who came from humble origins in Britain and ended up in India, Calcutta, serving for the East India Company, decided to take on the Nawab and his army. So, long story short, Nawab's army was very big. It was 50,000 against 5,000 British soldiers. 50,000. There was no chance. The British had no chance. But because the Nawab was betrayed, as bad as he was betrayed by his own wazir called Mir Jafar. He betrayed him. And as a result, the Battle of Plassey in 1757 was lost. Okay, and Nawab had to run for his life. He was caught and he was killed. And then his vizier, Mir Jafar, was put on the throne instead of the Nawab himself. So he became the Nawab of Bengal, right? So that's why to this day in India and Pakistan, the Muslims or the Indians in general use this insult. If you want to insult someone, you say Mir Jafar. You call him Mir Jafar or Mir Sadiq. I'll come to Mir Sadiq later, okay? Mir Jafar. To the extent that the poet, he said, Jafar as Bengal, Sadiq as Dakkan, Nange Deen, Nange Millat, Nange Watan. Basically, he said that the Jafar of Bengal and the Sadiq of Dakkan of southern India, basically they have no deen, they have no loyalty, they have no land, basically. So this is why these two names became, because of the betrayal, they became very infamous, right? So Clive takes... he wins the battle, and clearly now they have the confidence the British never had. The East India Company have this confidence, having defeated one of the most formidable militaries in India, right? One of the richest provinces in India. They have defeated this. They cannot believe what happened. So now they have become more confident. So confident that now the East India Company wants to take on a coalition of Mughal militaries. So Shah Alam II, the Mughal Emperor in Delhi, and Nawab Shuja'ud-Daulah from Awadh, the state of Awadh, and Mir Qasim, the Nawab of Bengal, in 1764, they form a coalition to fight the British East India Company in a very famous battle called the Battle of Buxar. In 1764, these two armies meet face to face. General Monroe is leading the army in the Battle of Buxar, and shockingly, three militaries of the Mughals are defeated. A coalition of three militaries from three different states, defeated. And this was the end of Bengal, Bihar and Orissa, the richest provinces of India. Now the Mughal emperor by force in 1765 under the Treaty of Allahabad, he had to relinquish the rights of taxation to the British in these provinces. The British, they could not believe their luck. They could not believe what they were seeing. They could not imagine this could ever happen in their lifetime. The East India Company is a trading company. Now they have become a formidable military power in India with immense money at their disposal. They became so rich that Clive, when he defeated Nawab Sirajuddaula in 1757, that Clive, that one person, was given 250,000 pounds, 250,000 British pounds sterling. I mean, equal, of course, in Indian rupees, but he was given 250,000 pounds as a present or as a gift, as a gesture of kindness from the new Nawab, Mir Jafar. And you know what that money was? Can you imagine how much that money was in the 18th century? 250,000 pounds. Can you imagine? How much was a house in Britain? In the 1960s, how much was a house? About 5,000 pounds. Just imagine. Go back to the 18th century. Clive became a billionaire overnight. Having won this battle, he became a billionaire. He collected all this money. He comes back to Britain, buys land, buys estates, okay, and buys a seat in the parliament. You know, at that time in the 18th century, you could actually, if you had the money, you can buy a seat. You could actually buy a seat in the parliament, okay? You didn't have to be elected, okay? So the process of election was different at that time. So he bought a seat. But then he was impeached. He was put on trial for corruption, for acquiring all this money. So this Clive of India, he said to his questioners that, "I saw treasures in India beyond your imaginations. Vaults were opened to me, filled with gold and precious jewels. And these Indian bankers, Hindu bankers and Muslim rulers, they would basically pay anything for a smile from me. And yet here I stand, being put on trial for being moderate." Basically saying, I'm quite moderate. What I brought back with me is trivial. It's nothing in comparison to what I have left behind. So they sent Clive back in 1765. Clive was sent back to India to sort some problems out. He comes back, and a result of his coming back was the Treaty of Allahabad in 1765. And now the British had their hands on power. They could not imagine money, immense money coming from Bengal, because all the factories, all the economic, a lot of economics were taking, you know, economic activity was taking place in Bengal. Cloth was being produced. There was rich agriculture. Bengal is to this day is agriculturally the richest province of India. Okay, so the British had all this money, and then slowly and steadily they started to expand their territory throughout India. They started to use rulers against rulers. They started to conspire. They got more and more arrogant. Firstly, in the 18th century, the British were heavily inspired by the Mughals, because the Mughals were very powerful. They had a very rich culture. They had rich art. They had rich language, rich poetry, rich philosophy. You name it. You look at Islamic manuscripts from the Mughal period, your head will spin. When you look at those Persian manuscripts written in the Persian language, Persian poetry of Hafiz Shirazi, and some Indian poets in the Persian language during the Mughal period, is going to spin your minds. The philosophy those guys were writing, the works on theology, hadith and Quran manuscripts, gold illuminated, you know, artwork, miniatures. You look at, and the architecture. If you look at the architecture, the Taj Mahal, everyone talks about the Taj Mahal, but if you look at other things they created, the Red Fort, okay, of Delhi, and the Badshahi Mosque of Lahore, and the Shahi Fort of the Lahore, and the list goes on and on and on. Mughal architecture, Fatehpur Sikri alone in Fatehpur in India, is going to really, really, really inspire you. So the Mughals created all of this. They had a very powerful, rich culture. So these British merchants and their officers, when they came to India, they were completely mesmerized. They were blown away. by this pomp and glitter and culture and richness, they got immersed into this culture. And they started to adopt the Mughal culture. They started to dress like Mughals. You would see white men in India in the 18th century walking around in Mughal clothes. Right? Nowadays, you go to Pakistan, India, what do they want to look like? They want to look like the white man, right? Because the white man is politically, yeah, economically dominant. When I say the white man, I mean the Western civilization. I don't mean in a racist sense, right? I'm not talking in a racist sense. I'm saying, you know, it is like in a civilizational term, you know. So they want to dress like the white man. Okay, but the white man at that time in the 18th century wanted to dress like the Mughal, because the Mughal culture was dominant, right? So a book has been written on this very topic by an English author, actually Scottish, he's not English, his name is William Dalrymple. William Dalrymple has written a book titled The White Mughals. The White Mughals. So if you read this book, he shows you how a lot of these English white men working for East India Company and for their interests in different courts of India were adopting the Indian culture. There was no reason to be proud and haughty against the Indians. There was no reason to look down upon them because the Indians are so powerful and so rich and so culturally vibrant. It is only in the early 19th century when the white man in India became racist, very, very proud, and had this sense of white supremacy and even religious supremacy. So they started to look down. When India was bled dry by the East India Company and its policies, when Indians actually became poor because of this foreign power that had occupied so much land and so much intrigue was caused by this particular power, that the Indians, who were once upon a time the richest people in the world, became the poorest people in the world.